You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today.
Yeah, it's maybe not practical from the standpoint of being able to actually use it, but from a fundamental physics standpoint, it's amazing.
The final part of our countdown of the biggest physics stories of 2018 with Ian Durham.
So this is when things start to get interesting and potentially controversial. We are in deep, deep, deep trouble. And we're talking about an extinction-level event.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to the final part of the Foundational Questions Institute review of the biggest physics stories of the past year. The stories have been chosen by FQXI member and quantum physicist Ian Durham of St Anselm College in New Hampshire, and if you missed part one, it's still up on the website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. In the last edition, we heard the results that took joint fifth place. Now.
Okay, so fourth place, I have to give a full disclosure that one of the researchers who contributed to the fourth place result is an acquaintance of mine, Fabio Costa. Fabio and some folks down in the University of Queensland have used an experiment to show quantum mechanics actually defies causal ordering.
I've seen this on the press release described as the chicken and egg paradox, which I thought was really nice. And one news item about it just ran a video of a chicken and some chicks and eggs and things, which also, I think, livened up perhaps the visual for the experiment.
I think the biologists answered that question.
Right, did they?
I think the egg came before the chicken.
The egg came before the chicken. Oh, well, then we don't even need to talk about this quantum one now, do we?
No, it's the quantum one. So these guys created a quantum switch in which photons can take one of two paths. One path involves being subjected to a particular operation, we'll call it operation A, that occurs before operation B. In the other path, B occurs before A. And the order in which the operations are performed is determined by the initial polarization of the photon as it enters the switch. I will stay away from using the word time here, and I will simply say causal order. If the system has definite causal order, the polarization of the output photon should be affected by the order in which these things are done. Basically, the team did the experiment using several different types of so A and B, they actually had lots of different A's and B's, right, to test different types of things. And in every single case, they found that the measured polarization of the output photons was consistent with there being no causal order, no definite causal order between A and B. As far as the photons went, A and B didn't occur in any particular order at all. And it's fascinating.
At the risk of sounding very stupid now, I'm not sure I'm following really the experiment or even what it means for the photons, the polarized photons that went through the experiment.
So think about it this way. Forget about the polarization for a second. So we'll think about it in terms of balls going through boxes, right? Imagine we have a box and you can put balls in it and there are two outputs and the balls will randomly either go out of output R or output L, okay? Actually, here's an even better. Let's say they're not balls. Let's say they're cubes. And the faces are all numbered. Let's say in one path, you paint the cube. The painting happens on only one face.
Right.
And then you rotate it. Okay. So you paint it, and then you rotate it. In the other arm, you rotate it, and then you paint it.
Right.
The key is that you can tell which order they're done in, right?
Right.
Let's say they're both six-sided dice. Side six is the side that gets painted if it's painted first. If it's not painted first, it gets rotated to side four, and side four is painted. So when they come out, either side six will be painted or side four will be painted. But in this case, it's like it doesn't matter. They're both six or they're both four. You can't tell. There's no way to differentiate between the arms, right?
Right. So your photons go in, there's operation A then B in one arm, there's operation B then A on the other arm, and when they come out and you recombine them and you look at the result you get, you can't really see the result you're expecting if they've both gone through these operations in different orders. It just looks like they've gone through in the same order or just something completely different, but not what you would basically have predicted.
Yeah, it's basically a which way question, right? What we're saying is you can't tell which path any given photon took, right? So it's the same as a which way kind of experiment. And if there's no way to tell that difference, and that difference is created by the ordering of those two operations, then there must not be any order to those operations.
Okay, so on the one hand, you know, that just sounds like, wow, that's weird and crazy and interesting, but it's quantum, and quantum's often weird and crazy and interesting. But the foundational question here, you're interested in time, you're writing a book about time. You know, one thing we sort of say about time is that, you know, we don't understand where the arrow of time comes from. At a sort of microscopic level, there shouldn't be any time. Is this getting us somewhere towards answering these massive questions that we've been thinking about for, I don't know, centuries? Or is it sort of a new, unexpected thing that doesn't really help us solve those problems, but maybe is introducing a new problem?
No, I think it actually makes a significant progress in this regard. In fact, it's evidence to the fact that there really is no arrow of time at the quantum level, which is actually what I personally have long suspected. It suggests that time is maybe an emergent property. And in fact, it suggests that to some extent, causal order is an emergent property, which, again, I don't find any of that unusual. It's something I have long suspected. But, you know, it's really cool to see it. And this is just a really elegant and brilliant experiment.
So before moving on, I should say this was published in Physical Review Letters, and I'm just looking through, you know, one of these articles about it. This one is in Physics World. At the end, they're sort of saying, you know, it's not just sort of interesting for foundational reasons, it's also interesting because it could have real practical applications, like making computers more efficient or improving communication. And so I guess I'll ask you, there's usually one that I ask you this same question about every year, which is, is this really true? Is this kind of result really going to help us improve computing in the future? Or is that just something that they like to say at the end just to justify their funding and pretend that there are sort of practical implications of this?
It will help us understand how quantum computers work better. There's no question about that. So I don't think that's just asking for funding. So the U.S. Air Force funds a lot of those things. They wouldn't fund it if they didn't think it had some kind of practical implications. On the other hand, the U.S. Air Force also funded a lot of black hole research, so back in the 50s. So who knows?
I'm just thinking, I went to a meeting not that long ago, a couple of years ago, about using black holes as a clean energy source. Oh, I guess, you know, the idea was to make black holes and to extract energy from them somehow.
Okay.
So... there you go. It's probably not worth me talking about it in any more detail than that. It was a little bit strange, but we've gone off on another weird tangent again. So
yes.
So third place,
another one of these really fun ones. This literally just came out. The record for a high temperature superconductivity has been smashed again, and the reason this one made my list is because it's actually at a temperature found on Earth naturally. Now, I will admit these guys are chemists, and I can't believe I'm putting chemists on this list, but I am. They did a good job. And they're at Max Planck's Institute for Chemistry in Germany. They observed lanthanum hydride superconducting at 250 Kelvin, which is minus 23 degrees Celsius. Now, that may sound really, really cold, but if you've ever lived in Canada or the northern plains of the United States, mm-hmm. or perhaps places like Mongolia or something like that, you will know that minus 23 Celsius routinely occurs. In fact, here in New England, where I live, the top of Mount Washington is notorious for being home of the world's worst weather. Last winter, they had regular times when it was, you know, of course, we record in Fahrenheit here, but it was minus 50, minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which is colder than this, and this thing was superconducting at that temperature. The holy grail of superconductivity is superconducting at room temperature. And, well, you know, at the top of Mount Washington, that is room temperature.
You sent me this article again. This is from Technology Review. And one of the things they sort of said there was, this is a jaw-dropping surprise for physicists because of the nature of the superconducting material. So why was it such a big deal that it was in this particular material?
Physicists have a slightly different or stricter requirements to meet for something to be called a superconductor. And the first is there has to be the drop in resistance. Superconductivity is that at a certain temperature, a material has no resistance. As the temperature falls, the resistance should drop to zero at a specific point. They clearly have this. Then the second is that there has to be this replacement of the elements in the sample with heavier isotopes so that the lattice vibrates at a different rate and it changes the critical temperature accordingly. So these guys have that as well. They replaced the hydrogen in their samples with deuterium and the critical temperature changed to 168 Kelvin, which is what was expected. The third is that physicists usually expect to see the Meissner effect, which is that a superconductor should expel any magnetic field. And their samples are so small, with like a few microns across, that are inside some really, really high pressure, really high pressure cells, that they have not been able to measure it directly, though they do have some indirect evidence that the magnetic field has been expelled. Other than that, I think there's pretty much no doubt this is definitely superconducting.
I shared this on Twitter and got an angry response from somebody who said that we should specify that the sample has to be under huge pressure, 170 gigapascals, yep, which is about half the pressure at the center of the Earth. So don't get so excited.
I don't see why that takes away from the fascinating aspect of this. You think about, if that's half the pressure of the center of the Earth, I can imagine that that would be probably easily achieved on some larger planets, right? If you were to have lanthanum hydride, now I don't know if you would, but suppose you had lanthanum hydride in the center of some planet somewhere, well, then you'd have the center of a planet that would have a superconductor in it, and it would, if it was a true superconductor, would expel its magnetic field. I understand that we're being cautious, but this is still huge. This is just amazing. This is just crazy. I don't care how great a pressure it is, it's still amazing. Yeah, it's maybe not practical from the standpoint of being able to actually use it, but from a fundamental physics standpoint, it's amazing.
So well done to the chemists there for getting onto your physics list. That's quite an achievement.
I think that's the first time I've put chemists on my list.
I know mathematicians get there all the time, and I'm not sure they should be, but chemists, no, you're quite snobbish about chemists.
Yeah, well.
Right then, number two.
All right, number two, this is when things start to get interesting and potentially controversial. Number two was originally going to be number one, and the only possible thing that could knock it off of number one is what number one is, and we'll get to that when we get to it.
Right.
Number two is Donna Strickland winning the Nobel Prize. Only three women have ever won the Nobel Prize in Physics in its history, and they are Madame Curie, who won twice, once in physics and once in chemistry, and then Maria Geppert-Mayer, who won in 1964, and then Donna Strickland this year. And so the last time a woman has won a Nobel Prize in Physics was 1964. That was 10 years before I was born. What little hair I have left on my head is gray. Well, as of a few weeks ago, I have an adult child. So it gives you an idea of how long ago that was. And the fact that in its history, we've only awarded three.
So we should say we haven't sort of celebrated what it was she actually won for. So Donna Strickland, Gerard Mourou, and Arthur Ashkin share the prize for various discoveries to do with lasers, basically, for slightly different things. In Strickland's case, it was for
basically generating high-intensity ultra-short optical pulses. So Ashkin won it for optical tweezing, and then she and Mourou, who was her PhD advisor, so basically this was her PhD work. I think they were at the University of Rochester at the time. It was finding a method of generating really high-intensity but ultra-short optical pulses.
And this was in her first ever scientific paper.
Yeah, and she is well recognized as an excellent physicist. I shouldn't even say that. She won the Nobel Prize. But this shouldn't be second place because she's a woman. This should be second place because it's a great discovery. Of course, it was made a long time ago before we did this podcast. But the fact that she's a woman and only the third to win, it highlights the fact that we have a problem in our field. There are large systemic problems in science in general, but particularly in physics, that have made it very difficult for women to advance. You sent me a note about the so-called Strumia affair, which was the physicist, well, I guess he was at CERN, but he's part of the University of Pisa in Italy, and he used the opportunity provided by a conference on theory and gender to make suggestions that were similar to the types of suggestions that Larry Summers made back in the 1990s, that perhaps there might be a reason that there aren't as many women in science, and that that reason might have something to do with, you know, some biological thing. Maybe women just aren't actually cut out for it. Of course, that's a load of BS. And so I am acknowledging Donna Strickland for her Nobel Prize, not just for the fact that she did some phenomenal work. And in fact, it really is about the fact that she did phenomenal work. And so many other women have done phenomenal work and have been continuously, I have to watch my language because this is a family-friendly podcast, they've been mistreated over the course of their careers. One of the more egregious examples is Madame Wu back in the 50s or 60s, where her collaborators got the Nobel Prize for work that she did. And that sort of thing happens routinely in our field.
So I did send you the Strumier article, and, you know, and I feel slightly conflicted about giving him more airtime on the podcast for his bizarre ideas, because I think they don't even kind of stand up to scrutiny when people sort of looked at his claims that were made. But one of them, you know, let me put this to you. It was in a BBC News article reporting on what it was he'd said. He also, I guess, is very worried that men are being discriminated against now in physics. And so I just wondered about your thoughts on that.
Oh, my God. I don't even know where to begin with that. This is a typical argument that is made by people who are in power, who feel that their power is being threatened. And when I say in power, I don't mean in power in the sense of they're in a powerful position. I mean, they're part of a historically powerful group. You have a group that's been marginalized for a very, very long time. And as soon as that group starts to try to get some sense of equality, there's a backlash from the people who have historically been in power. And it's sad and it's too bad, but that's what Strumia's problem is he feels threatened by women.
There has been pressure over a number of years on the Nobel Prize Committee to recognize more women. And as you say, there are many, many examples of people that were snubbed and overlooked and who still are being snubbed and overlooked. Do you think that having given this prize now to Donna Strickland, is this a sign of something changing, or is it just going to be back to usual business next year? And maybe this isn't something that's completely restricted to physics or even the Nobel Prize, but you sort of get a sense that when there is enough political pressure, you know, people make a show of saying that things are changing, and then, you know, next year it probably will be back to normal again.
So that's a really tough question to answer. And I think part of the problem with that is that there are two things going on. The systemic problems of sexism and misogyny in science have never gone away. And one of the consequences of those problems is that there are not very many women in the field. So that does create a problem. The big breakthroughs of any given year or any given decade, you don't see a whole lot of women involved in them, partly because there just aren't that many women in the field, and that right there is a problem in and of itself. We need more women. I will say this. If you look at my list, I'm pretty sure there is at least one woman on every single one of these projects. The first author on Fabio Costa's paper on quantum mechanics defies causal order was Jackie Romero, and I'm pretty sure there were women involved in the ice cube experiment, and I think the hydrogen one as well. So I think down the road there should be. We'll know, I suppose, in the next few years.
Anyway, congratulations to Donna Strickland and the others named as winners for the Nobel Prize in Physics this year. Even if she didn't make it to number one on Ian Durham's list, which I think, you know, must obviously be very disappointing for her. So she'll just have to make do with the Nobel Prize. But what has displaced her?
The only possible thing that could possibly displace Donna Strickland winning the Nobel Prize is something of existential crisis level. That is the fact that the UN Climate Summit that recently occurred basically gave us, as in humanity, 12 years to stave off a planetary disaster. So once again, I am taking my bully pulpit. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, talking to FQXI listeners, but humanity is in a very serious spot right now. We are talking about an actual breakdown of civilization as we know. I don't think people really understand how troublesome things will get if we don't do something fast. And the UN Climate Summit that just occurred recently gave us 12 years to stave off this disaster. Otherwise, we are in deep, deep, deep trouble. And we're talking about an extinction-level event.
Right, so a nice jolly one to end on then.
Happy holiday.
So first of all, let's talk about this then. Let's talk about why do we have so little time? What is it we're trying to do in that amount of time?
Well, so, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Global warming, which they changed it to climate change because supposedly it was a more palatable thing. You know, some people say, well, it's more accurate to talk about climate change. Well, whatever. The fact is that it's global warming. The average temperature of the planet is going up. And we know exactly why it's going up. There is no debate about this. We know that we're causing it. We are the cause of it. There is absolutely no debate. The evidence is unequivocal. And we know where the sources of the carbon are even coming from. We can pinpoint exactly where it's coming from, who's putting out how much, and how much. We can even get it down to individual people. So we know where the carbon is coming from. We know that adding carbon to the atmosphere is making it warmer. And in fact, astronomers know exactly what a runaway greenhouse effect will do to a planet, because it happened on Venus. Not obviously for the same reason, but we know that Venus had a runaway greenhouse effect, and it has a surface that is so inhospitable. The Russians tried to land a satellite on Venus in the 1970s, and it lasted about 10 minutes before it melted. Ooh. So it's not hospitable to life in the long term. I mean, I think part of the problem is humans are not very good at long-term thinking. You know, nobody is thinking past next week or next year. The problem is that we now have 12 years to stave off this disaster. And the 12-year number is right. I mean, that's a somewhat debatable number.
You know, as you were talking, you mentioned that the figure, the 12-year figure, is a bit arbitrary. And I'm glad you did that, because I was going to bring in a piece that was written by Michael Marshall for Forbes, which addresses that point. And for him, he was sort of saying that it's not helpful to kind of pull out these numbers because, you know, if you claim that 12 years is going to be the point of no return, he says it's at best questionable and at worst actively confusing because there is no such cutoff. And I'm just quoting from him here. He says, you know, it's just a case that the problem gets worse and worse the later we leave it. And there's an argument for saying that if you put out a deadline like this, it's just going to create a feeling of hopelessness amongst people that we're just going to miss it anyway, rather than being sort of, you know, having a positive effect on people. But I mean, he's obviously kind of behind the idea that we need to do something soon. So in this article in Forbes, he runs through some of the different scenarios, and you're sort of talking about the different factors they've used in their analysis. So things like trying to predict how much we can increase renewable energy, you know, whether we'll be able to use technologies to remove carbon dioxide from the air and how much we can rely on those. And actually, in some of these analyses, in some of these scenarios, we've already passed the point of no return. In other ones, that maybe we've got a little bit longer.
The 12-year number it's arrived at by an analysis of what would need to be done to keep us under a certain threshold. And the threshold is picked because at these thresholds, we know certain things will happen, right? So at certain thresholds, X amount of ice will melt, which will raise sea temperatures by this much, which will warm up the planet by this much and cause this much flooding, et cetera, et cetera. So these are semi-arbitrary, but the fact is that we are not going to reverse global warming. We are beyond that point. The only thing we could possibly do at this point is slow it down to the point where maybe, just maybe, we might be able to hold it to a level that won't cause our own extinction. It blows my mind that I'm even sitting here talking about this and that I have to talk about this because we live in a world where there's a growing number of people who think the world is flat. People are going to laugh at that, but it's scary because there are some famous people who now claim this. And it's mind-boggling how much of a backlash against science there has been but yet how dependent on it we are, and people don't realize that, and how we are in so much trouble if we don't do something.
But the whole thing is, you know, it sounds, well, it is tremendously depressing, and it's sort of a bit of a downer to kind of end on. What are we telling our listeners here? Because the chances are that, you know, I'd like to think that our listeners are, you know, at the top levels of government in various countries, but the chances are they're probably... most of them are not these kind of big players who can affect policy and industry and all those sorts of things. So what are we telling our listeners? What should they take away from this?
Well, they should get angry and they should demand more of their political leaders. Yet that's true that, you know, it's the political leaders who make the decisions, but all political leaders, even the non-elected ones, so even your authoritarian leaders, they're all cognizant of the fact that they are in power because people allow them to be in power. At some point, if enough people are angry, even dictators fall. And my point here is that politicians are all subject to public opinion. And public opinion needs to get upset about this, needs to get angry. So it starts with us. It starts with us demanding that our leaders better represent us. I don't mean just political leaders. I also mean business leaders. You as listeners, we as scientists, we as citizens need to stand up and demand more of our leaders.
We're at the end of the list, maybe to give it a bit of a positive spin. At least we've got 12 years to stave off planetary disaster.
At least we have 12 years, yes.
So listeners, you have to contact your local politicians and put pressure on them to stop climate change and save the world, because otherwise this is going to be it for the next 12 years, the number one story on Ian's Countdown.
If you want to keep listening to this podcast, you know, eventually, if we don't do something, we will all melt. And be able to listen to the podcast because we'll all be goo.
Once again, thank you to Ian Durham for this year's review. And if you stay tuned right to the end of the podcast, you may hear a sneaky bonus choice, which is a lot more upbeat that almost made Ian's list. There's more information about all the stories mentioned so far on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Congratulations to the researchers who showed that, on a quantum level at least, the chicken and egg both came first, the international collaboration that smashed the temperature record for superconductivity, and to Donna Strickland, whose breakthrough with lasers made history this year as she won the Nobel Prize in Physics. I'm not sure congratulations are quite in order here, but you can also find out more about the IPCC report that says we only have a short amount of time to save ourselves from catastrophic climate change. If you disagree with Ian's choices, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Facebook at FQXI Physics. On Twitter, I'm at FQXI and Ian is at Quantum Moxie. Thank you for listening and wishing you the best for a happy and healthy 2019. I've been Zia Morali.
There was another one I was going to mention that just came out yesterday. You heard the amoeba that calculated an NP-hard problem in linear time.
No, an amoeba.
Which is just, you know, single-cell organism.
Hmm.
This is really, really cool. It was an amoeba, and they assigned the amoeba the traveling salesman problem, which is an NP-hard problem, and it solved it in linear time.
So really, I should get the amoeba onto the podcast and interview it.
Yes, yeah. I don't know how talkative the amoeba would be.
It can solve these problems. It should be able to chat for a few minutes on a podcast. I mean, okay, just because it's single-celled, I don't know.
This particular amoeba was actually Plasmodium, which is true slime mold.
I'm looking at the link. I'm just at a loss as to how it carried out a computation.
It has to do with, I guess, how it grew or something like that. Basically, it had something to do with light absorption and how it retreated from certain channels. I skimmed the article, which is another reason I didn't mention it, but it's pretty wild.
Yeah.
This one consumes oat flakes.
Food for champions, then.
Yeah.
That's what we should all be doing. Just imagine what we could achieve.
I know, if we were only amoeba.
So, if we have catastrophic climate change, will the amoeba survive and will they have a better civilization than we have, is the question.
You'd have to ask the amoeba.
Right. I will do that then. Thank you.
Did you actually record that?
I did record that.
Oh, okay.
That I think has to be the final line of the podcast. Surely you'd have to.
You'd have to ask Yumi, but that does have to be yes.